Iranians are heading to the polls today to elect their next president. Absent from the ballot, reform candidates who have been sidelined.
They have been checkmated by the radical conservatives of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Also today, not far from Atlanta, you'll find the nation's largest monument to the Confederacy and the city of Stone Mountain.
The city I live in is the shadow of the mountain that really don't have a lot to do with the city here.
How Stone Mountain is marking the Juneteenth holiday. In China, some black Americans are also marking the day.
The feeling of Juneteenth in the U.S. that I've never really experienced, we want to bring it here.
I'm Marco Werman, and looking to buy a new car? A quick tip, wait. If you can, we'll tell you why. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Iranians went to the polls today to choose their next president. There wasn't much suspense going into this election. It's widely expected that a hardline candidate supported by Iran's supreme leader will emerge the winner. Presidential elections were not always this way in the Islamic Republic. As The World's Shirin Jafari reports, not so long ago, well-known candidates calling for political reform were able to compete.
In the days leading up to this election, officials in Iran encouraged the public to get out and vote. They even enlisted the help of celebrities. In this video, actress Behnoosh Bakhtiari says, "We've all been through some challenging times, but now we should come together like a big family and work on changing the situation." A well-known soccer coach, Ali Parvin, chimed in too. He told Iranians that he's voting for hardline candidate Ebrahim Raisi and that anyone who doesn't like it here in Iran should leave. Even the supreme leader himself went on national TV telling Iranians if they don't vote, they'll make Iran's enemies happy. The message might not be getting through, though. Turnout this year was expected to be way down compared to past elections. That's partly because the hardline Guardian Council disqualified a large number of candidates. Elections in Iran have never been completely free and fair because the council decides who can run. The closest Iran came to having a genuine political movement that challenged the hardliners was in the 1990s, when cleric Mohammad Khatami ran as a reformist.
He campaigned on a mandate to bring about political change, more political and social and cultural freedoms for people, and massive numbers of people threw their support behind him.
Nazila Fathi is an author and a fellow with the Middle East Institute in Washington.
There was a lot of energy. There was a lot of hope.
Khatami won, and he became the symbol of a different Iran, one that wanted to open up to the West and that embraced some social freedoms. The hardliners saw their reform movement as a threat. To them, a more open and democratic Iran would undermine the religious establishment.
The regime marginalized all the prominent figures of the reform movement. Many of them were jailed, tortured, intimidated in public. And so no one from this movement has been in a position of power since then.
Fathi says this left a deep impact on many Iranians, especially the younger generation who had a lot of hope in the reform movement. They were disillusioned and discouraged, even angry. Ali Afshari was 24 years old at the time. He was a student leader.
I was eager to engage in politics, not in the professional form, but to seek goals like the democracy, human rights, political openings. That was my interest in that time.
The reform movement wanted to make change from within, he says. Afshari says he was not calling for overthrowing the government or starting a revolution. He wanted gradual, peaceful change. But the hardliners were not going to let that happen.
They attacked me, and a couple of times I was arrested, detained, and in one of the longest one I was tortured and spent near a year in solitary confinement.
Afshari left Iran and is now living in the U.S. He says his experience as part of the reform movement led him to change his mind. Now he's convinced that a more radical approach is needed, pushing for regime change.
Regime change, but by using of the support and engagement of the Iranian people, not from outside.
In this election, there are no prominent reformist candidates running for president. Some reformists have called for a boycott. Others have thrown their support behind a lesser-known candidate, who's also the former head of Iran's central bank. Mohsen Milani at the University of South Florida in Tampa says the reformists in Iran have their work cut out for them.
They have been checkmated by the radical conservatives of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and they need to reevaluate their assumptions and recalibrate their strategies.
He says it's up to those living inside Iran to decide how to revive the reform movement.
But the key is to develop ideas that are acceptable to the middle class, but especially to the Iranian youth. Simply put, they are much more modern and much more democratic in their orientation than the reformists are.
But at this point, is the reform movement in Iran dead? Nazila Fathi of the Middle East Institute doesn't think so. She says people's demands have changed. She mentions a letter published last month signed by more than 200 activists.
We see that they are calling for a change to the constitution, elimination of the position of the supreme leader. This is not reform. This is a complete political change from the current system to a new system.
The reform movement of the 1990s is on life support, she says. But the aspirations of many people inside Iran for a more open and democratic country are alive and well. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Tomorrow marks a new federal holiday here in the U.S., Juneteenth, a day to commemorate the end of slavery in the U.S. and the enslaved people in Texas who were the last to learn about emancipation. It's resonating with people all over the world. Later in the show, we'll hear a story about Juneteenth from Shanghai. Right now, we're focusing closer to home in Stone Mountain, Georgia, a small city about 15 miles from Atlanta and home to the largest Confederate monument in the U.S. The world's Rupa Shenoy has our story.
Stone Mountain Monument is often called the Confederate Mount Rushmore. It's about as big as a football field, etched into the granite side of a mountain. It depicts three Confederate heroes on horseback, President Jefferson Davis and Generals Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. The Daughters of the Confederacy funded the monument, and it looms over a valley the state of Georgia bought in 1958 to memorialize Southern history. White supremacists used it as a meeting place for years. This archival footage is from a PBS documentary called Graven Image.
Ku Klux Klansmen take over the little Georgia town of Stone Mountain. They direct traffic to their mass initiation meeting nearby, where the Klan adds fuel to a Southern revolt against civil rights legislation.
I grew up when the Klans were here.
Elaine Vaughn's family has lived in the city of Stone Mountain for three generations. The city surrounds the park, but has no jurisdiction over it.
You will hear the racial slurs. You would see the marches. You would see them in their attire, their gowns and hoods, burning their torches.
Tomorrow, the same main street Klansmen used to march down will be blocked off for a Juneteenth celebration Vaughn helped organize. She's never been to a Juneteenth event before.
So this is my first, and I am so excited. I am just excited.
These days, Stone Mountain City is nearly 80% Black. Vaughn lives in the historically Black neighborhood of Shermantown, named after Union General William T. Sherman. For the holiday, she's focused on celebrating the lives of her ancestors. That's why, as a member of the Juneteenth Planning Committee, she supported a group decision that's caused a controversy. They denied one of the first applications for an official vendor table at the event.
The city I live in is the shadow of the mountain. I know this. I understand this. But people must also realize that is a private mountain that really don't have a lot to do with the city here. Set aside for 3 hours and let that be on the back burner. Don't bring that to us.
That being the issue of what should happen to the Stone Mountain Monument. The application the planning committee denied was filed by a group that wants to end taxpayer funding for Stone Mountain Park. Sally Stanhope is with the Stone Mountain Action Coalition. It wants to let those Confederate heroes be slowly covered up by vines and lichen.
Denial does not match who we are as Georgians. We want to have a conversation. We want people across Atlanta, across Georgia and across the nation to be involved. And this conversation we see as liberation in the tradition of Juneteenth. And I think that's why we're so surprised that we were denied.
The group that governs the monument is considering changes. But in the meantime, emotions are running high. Last August, there was a violent confrontation at the park between far-right militia members and anti-racist groups. In March, Channel 2 local news covered a Confederate flag rally that was also met by counter-protesters.
The rally got heated.
What you guys say is founded upon racism.
When those on both sides of the issue faced off.
My white brothers are being deprived of having a culture.
This monument still inspires white supremacists, says Derricka Williams, another member of the Stone Mountain Action Coalition. She grew up in the city and still lives there.
How can you celebrate Juneteenth in totality without recognizing the role that places like Stone Mountain play and keeping people in bondage? Juneteenth is about freedom. Juneteenth is about removing shackles. And there's a big part of Stone Mountain that is kind of hell-bent on keeping shackles in place.
Williams says Stone Mountain Park whitewashes history. In recent years, it's marketed itself as an amusement park, drawing 4 million visitors a year. Now the three Confederate heroes loom over a valley filled with attractions like mini golf, a climbing wall, and water slides.
Welcome to Stone Mountain Park. We're so glad you're here. I don't know about you, but I've got a few kids to entertain, which is why Stone Mountain Park has become my all-day-long, out-in-nature, family-fun, go-to destination.
But the park's signage, historical markers, even its nightly laser show projected onto the mountainside, they all still speak of the glories of the Confederacy, without mentioning slavery. Williams says that should concern everyone, especially on Juneteenth.
It doesn't make any difference what your race is. If you aren't actively fighting against racism, then you are contributing to that problem.
Williams and her group are still planning to go to Stone Mountain's Juneteenth event to hand out information. And Stone Mountain Mayor Pro Tem Chikaira Johnson says they're welcome to do that. She leads the Juneteenth event committee and also supported denying the coalition a vendor table.
The city itself has collectively been trying to tell its story, how we are not that negative past for many years now, how we have grown into a more diverse and inclusive community. We are our separate city. We are not the park, and we are not that history.
Johnson says she hopes people will come out and enjoy the food, dancing, music, vendors, and the fireworks, too. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
I want to tell you a story from way back. Truck on down and dig me, Jack. In 1865, a Hepcat started some jive. He said, come on, Gate, and jump with me at the Juneteenth Jamboree.
Juneteenth Jamboree by Louis Jordan and his Timpani Five. It came out in 1940 as one side of a 78, the first commercial song about Juneteenth. Decca Records released it, but the center label on the record identified the song as June 10th Jamboree. Like many of us who were not taught about the history of Juneteenth in school, Decca didn't know either, and according to most of the accounts, the executives in charge heard the chorus as June 10th. Now we know.
The rhythm was swinging at the picnic grounds, fried chicken floating all around. Everybody there was full of glee at the Juneteenth Jamboree. Trumpets flaring in the air, mellow barbecue everywhere. Clarinets moaning.
Coming up next, how Americans in Shanghai plan to celebrate Juneteenth. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Returning to our coverage of the Juneteenth celebration, over the past few years, understanding and recognizing the day has steadily been increasing, and not just here in the U.S. The World's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai spoke with Black Americans in China about marking this important holiday far from the place where it started.
Ayana Najuma is an American teacher working in China. She moved here 4 years ago, after 15 years working in Cincinnati public schools. She says she has no intention of returning.
I am safe as a brown person in China. You know, of course, there are CCTV cameras everywhere monitoring our comings and goings. And so that allows me a great deal of comfort, chances are no one is going to try to harm me.
Najuma says she's enjoying her time here, but it can feel isolating. The city she lives in, Hefei, has more people than New York City. But Najuma says she can count on one hand the number of people she's seen who look like her. That's why this weekend, Najuma is traveling almost 300 miles away to Shanghai to join one of China's first Juneteenth celebrations. Najuma says she celebrated the holiday as a child at barbecues her mom helped organize. This will be her first time celebrating in China.
I'm looking forward to getting some real serious hugs. Just those deep, soul-grabbing hugs.
Some of the organizers of Shanghai's Juneteenth celebration actually didn't grow up observing the holiday. Bruce Robinson and his wife Tess came to Shanghai 15 years ago on a one-year assignment and ended up staying. Now he works as an executive coach here.
You can find your community and you can recreate that Black experience even outside the United States.
Before the pandemic, he organized a Black men's group, a kind of barbershop group for networking and mentoring. But they haven't met in person for over a year now. He says as China recovers from COVID-19, the time is ripe for a return to in-person gatherings.
We get a chance to come together and celebrate our heritage, even though many of us are not able to return home. Some people haven't seen their loved ones for over a year. And I really think people are looking for that sense of community.
He and the other organizers thought a Juneteenth celebration might be a way to grow the Black business network here. Black-owned businesses will be at the event selling their products and services.
There's an entrepreneurship by example and of recycling Black dollars, if you will, through commerce.
Fellow organizer William Fraser first came to Shanghai 20 years ago. He put down roots here, married a Chinese woman, and started his own business. Even though he's never actually celebrated Juneteenth before, he says he hopes this will become an annual celebration with music, art, and culture.
In essence, we want to bring the feeling of Juneteenth in the U.S. that I've never really experienced. We want to bring it here. In other words, we want people to just let their hair down.
And that is what people like Ayana Najuma hope to do on Saturday.
We are going to love on each other because we know we're all that we have in this moment in time that we get to share together.
She says, we will come as strangers, but we will leave as family. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
In North Korea, the ruling party has been meeting this week. According to state media, leader Kim Jong-un said his country should prepare for both dialogue and confrontation with the United States. The statement comes days after the U.S. and other Group of Seven nations called on North Korea to abandon its nuclear weapons program. Our next guest has been following this closely. John Everard is a former ambassador from the U.K. to North Korea. Ambassador, dialogue and confrontation, and those were Kim Jong-un's words. It's kind of like prepare for night and day. How do you interpret that?
They've been saying this or something very similar for quite a long time now, keeping both doors open, stressing that they're open to dialogue, but that they're prepared to stand up for themselves if they feel that their honor and dignity is being infringed, in their favorite phrase, or if they feel the U.S. is bullying them. So the formulation was not a tremendous surprise.
There's been other news out of the ruling party conference as well. Kim Jong-un made reference to the fact that there have been food shortages in North Korea. Admitting that seems big for Kim. What are you reading into that?
Firstly, you have to look at Kim Jong-un's remarks on this alongside the latest report on the food situation in North Korea from the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, which came out just a few days ago on the 14th of June. And there's quite a difference. The United Nations is saying that, yes, North Korea is short of food, but then North Korea usually is short of food, and this year doesn't look very much worse than previous years. But the North Korean regime is clearly very worried about the food situation. Either Kim Jong-un and his advisors know something that the United Nations don't know to make them believe the food situation is actually a great deal worse, or he is worried about the gap between what is going on the ground in North Korea and his own rhetoric. This goes back to the Singapore summit. We all focused on what President Trump and Chairman Kim said to each other. But the real message to the North Korean people was what he showed of Singapore. Uncensored pictures of a modern, glistening city-state, lights on, bright skyscrapers. And this went out prime time, North Korean television. Chairman Kim was telling the North Korean people that things could get better. He was giving them a vision of the future. 3 years on, he hasn't delivered on any of those implied promises. Indeed, life has got quite a lot harder for ordinary North Koreans. And I think that politically, Kim Jong-un is starting to feel the heat.
Well, that's interesting because there has been speculation about Kim Jong-un himself. There were these photos that were released recently that showed him looking noticeably thinner than before. There was also a document leaked a few weeks ago saying he may have a new second in command. So what's going on with Kim Jong-un?
I have to say that the evidence that I've seen for real serious health problems has been rather scant. And I am left wondering whether the moves that we saw in the party Congress in January, where, as you rightly say, the Congress created the position of a second in command in the party, whether they are designed to reflect not physical weakness, but political weakness, whether Kim Jong-un is actually being slowly pushed to the sidelines in the actual implementation of power in North Korea. It may be that the shock of the failed Hanoi summit, and remember that Americans present in the room there have said that when President Trump walked out, Chairman Kim went white. This was the shock of his political life, that the failure of that policy has damaged him to the extent that bigwigs in the party are now moving to a system where life can work without Chairman Kim having to sign all the papers. If so, that would be a tremendous step.
If you were advising President Biden then, Mr. Ambassador, how would you tell him to proceed through what appears to be some early signs of some kind of pivot?
I would suggest that he renews his efforts to establish a channel for dialogue with North Korea. Now, this is a frustrating job. The administration's been trying hard to do this ever since it came to office and has got very little response. Maybe a message of some kind to Chairman Kim, just telling him that, you know, I, President Biden, I've heard what you say, dialogue or confrontation, let's do dialogue and see what he says.
John Everard is a former British diplomat who was UK ambassador to North Korea from 2006 to 2008. Ambassador, thank you very much for your thoughts.
You're very welcome.
We'll be right back with the second half of the show. You're listening to The World. If you're one of those looking to buy a new car, be prepared to wait or pay through the nose.
Now is not the time to buy if you can hold off. When I was looking for a car, the guy asked me for $6,000 above sticker price. I said, you know what? I'll see you in a year.
Global supply chain chaos. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Ignition.
That's a Chinese spacecraft this week taking off, the launch broadcast there by China's CCTV. Then 7 hours later, viewers saw the three astronauts on board docking at China's new space station, then speaking from what is their new home for the next 3 months. Astrophysicist Jonathan McDowell has been following this. He joins us from his home in Somerville, Massachusetts. So tell us about China's space station, Jonathan. I gather it's still under construction?
That's right. So they launched the first module, Tianhe, which is the core piece of the space station, earlier this year. They followed that up with an automatic docking by a cargo ship that came up and docked on the back end of Tianhe, and then now the Shenzhou 12 spaceship that's like a bus taking the astronauts up to the space station has arrived at the front end. But they have got an ambitious plan to stick extra modules on the sides of the space station to make it into a much larger space complex, not as large as the International Space Station, but still much more ambitious than anything China's done in space to date.
So a big part of these three astronauts' mission up there is to basically be construction workers?
That's right. Well, first they've just got to, you know, unpack all the boxes, right? It's like whenever you move into a new home, you've got to unpack everything that was secured for launch. You've got to plug in the refrigerator, all those sorts of home tasks. They also want to test out their new toys. And one of the main new toys that they have is a robot arm, a bit like the one on the International Space Station, that can be used as a crane to move equipment around and to berth satellites, as well as test out their new spacesuits. China doesn't have a lot of experience in spacewalking. They've only done one so far. And so they're going to do two spacewalks on this expedition.
So this is the Tiangong space station. How does it compare with the ISS, the International Space Station, which has been now orbiting the Earth for two decades? And as long as we're doing the moving homes metaphor, if the two space stations are houses, how would Zillow compare them?
So I would say that the International Space Station is that one you look at on the real estate pages and go, oh, I wish I was that rich. China's lab is, you know, it's a decent two-family home. It's got all the trimmings, but it's much more like the Mir space complex that the Soviets put up in the 1980s. It's really not on the scale of ambition of the International Space Station. And it will allow China, though, to test out how their astronauts can survive for long periods of time in space. Their record in space so far is only a month at a time, and this first mission is planned for 3 months. The other thing is that, you know, stuff goes wrong, as in any home. Things break and you have to repair them. And so they're going to find out how to maintain a laboratory in orbit for long periods of time, which is going to be critical when they do more ambitious human spaceflight projects like sending astronauts to the moon and Mars, where if something breaks, you can't come home immediately.
I can imagine the Chinese would benefit from learning from experienced missions, and the ISS is known for international cooperation, perhaps the one place where Russia and the U.S. consistently work together. But I gather that Tiangong space station is off limits for the U.S. Why is that, and who imposed that?
It's the U.S. that has a political problem with working in space with China. And China at one point was interested in participating in the International Space Station. But in Congress, there was a concern that when we had flown commercial American satellites on Chinese rockets in the 1990s, some of that technology had made its way to the Chinese space program and even to the Chinese missile program. And so the order came down severely restricting any bilateral contacts in space between the U.S. and China, and that froze China out of the whole ISS program and forced them to develop their own systems.
Was there an opportunity for space diplomacy that the U.S. missed here?
I think so, potentially. I mean, the technology transfer concern is real, but I think there was a less blanket way to deal with it that could have encouraged China to come more in the fold of International Space Corporation and encouraged them to adopt more of the norms on things like space debris that the rest of the world does. So I do regret the fact that China has been kept such at arm's length.
So Jonathan, as an astrophysicist who looks at the sky for a living, how big a deal is the building of a new space station by China?
Well, I think it's a real milestone in their human spaceflight program. It's also going to be geopolitically important for them. As we did on the ISS and as the Russians did on Mir, they're going to be able to invite astronauts from friendly countries to come and visit. They've already got experiments from a bunch of different countries, including European countries, that are going to be hosted on the Chinese station. And so it's an instrument of soft power in that sense.
Jonathan McDowell works at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. He's been telling us about China's space station, Tiangong. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
You can see China's historic liftoff. Check out our photo essay at theworld.org. Late last year, we began telling you about the conflict in northern Ethiopia in the province of Tigray. Ethiopia's government tried to disarm its political rivals in the north. Intense violence, massive displacement of Tigrayan civilians. Today, there is talk of a famine in Tigray. Humanitarian workers trying to help people crossing the border into eastern Sudan say they show clear signs of starvation as well as trauma. The International Rescue Committee's Madiha Raza recently returned from the region. She joins us from Nairobi. Can you tell us about some of the refugees you met, Madiha, who had fled into Sudan? What sort of stories did they share with you, especially about accessing food?
Most of them were, you know, severely traumatized, quite underweight, telling stories of the atrocities they'd seen whilst they fled from Tigray to East Sudan. You know, many of them had arrived severely malnourished. In Tigray itself, as you know, there were massive issues of getting access to food and supplies during the height of the conflict at the end of last year. you know, children were arriving unaccompanied, and women are having to, for example, engage in sexually exploitative relationships and exchange sex for money, just very small amounts of money, just in order to survive and feed their children. So it is quite a tragic situation.
So as accurate as famine sounds like it may be to describe what's happening in Tigray, famine's also a word that is highly charged. It's one the Ethiopian government does not want to hear. It doesn't want to be seen as the bad guy here. It's my understanding that humanitarian groups worry that if it is called a famine, they might not be let into the region. Can you explain that?
There are some conflicting reports about the level of hunger we're seeing in Tigray at the moment. There's no doubt that there are rising levels of hunger in Tigray and Ethiopia at large at the moment. And what I can say for sure is that if the planting season continues to be disrupted because of the lack of rain or because of the conflict, both in Tigray and in the Oromia region, come, you know, next few months, September time, let's say, we will see catastrophic levels of hunger definitely around then, if we're not already seeing it now.
As you know, Pope Francis at his noon prayer last Sunday demanded that humanitarian aid reach hungry people inside Tigray. What impact do his words have? And can you talk about the kind of access aid groups like yours, the IRC, actually have?
So at the height of the conflict, there were issues with access, especially in the rural areas, and that did ease up in the recent months. But there are still definitely access issues, especially in the rural areas where the humanitarian aid is needed most. So one of the things we are calling for is access, unfettered access to all those areas that are affected.
I want to ask you about women, especially unaccompanied women. They're so vulnerable in these sorts of situations, and there have been atrocious accounts of what many women have been through since last November. What stories did they share with you? Did they feel comfortable sharing with you?
So many of the women we'd spoken to had told us of the atrocities that have been perpetrated against them, including gang rape, including, as I mentioned earlier, the sexually exploitative relationships they're having to engage in. Women are highly at risk because of the fact that the places that they're sleeping are not segregated, and they don't have the protection they require to be safe in those situations as well. So that's one of the things we're trying to mitigate against by providing gender-based counseling services and also trying to raise awareness of the risks that women could face within these camps as well.
And then there are the children streaming into Sudan from Tigray. What's life like for them?
I think the number was around 6,000 children that had arrived unaccompanied in East Sudan, again, severely traumatized. I mean, we're trying to help at least reunite them with their families or at least put them in foster care. And of course, with the levels of hunger we're seeing in the country at the moment, this obviously has secondary impacts such as stunted growth. One of the mothers I spoke to told us that, you know, her son had been falling out of bed because of the nightmares he was having multiple times in one night because of what he'd seen as he fled from Tigray to East Sudan.
Madiha Raza is a senior global communications officer at the International Rescue Committee. She recently returned from Eastern Sudan, where she met refugees fleeing Ethiopia's Tigray province. She's been speaking with us from Nairobi. Madiha, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
In Somaliland, camels are a way of life. These beasts of burden haul food and water and also serve as transportation. It's been that way for centuries, but as our partners at Economist Radio have discovered, the ancient ways of buying and selling camels is under threat. Here's The Economist chief Africa correspondent, John McDermott.
These hunt wonders are a big deal in Somali culture. They are the main livestock export, and they provide delicious milkshakes in the capital of Somaliland, Hargeisa. When I was there recently on a particularly windy day, I popped down to the market. It's an incredible place. It's noisy, it's chaotic. You've got goats bleating and camels bellowing. And all of these participants in the market, the buyers, the sellers, they're all shouting loudly, saying, "My camel's stronger than your camel," or "Buy this one, it's got great meat by its ribs." But when it actually comes to buying one, to reaching a price, everything, however, goes silent. Let's pretend you are the seller and I'm the buyer of the camel. What we would do is we would put our arms together underneath a cloak, often a black cloak, and then we would move our hands in sync with the buyer, suggesting to the seller, using clasps of fingers and knuckles, exactly how much he wanted to pay. And if that wasn't right at first, the seller would maneuver it a bit. And on and on and on it goes, like a human abacus, these hands are. And eventually they come to a price, the shawl goes off and they shake hands. And it's been going on for centuries. Somali poets have written about it. Explorers have told tales about it. But it's also, as well as a cultural practice, an economic one. There's a concept in economics called asymmetric information, which is a technical term for when some people in a market know things that other people don't, and thus market failures arise. And that's what's going on here, because if you're not under the shawl, so to speak, you're not clear what prices are being paid for camels. So when you take your turn to try and buy one, you may get ripped off. You may get charged a higher price because you don't know what was being paid the last time. That has obviously served these mostly male, mostly powerful camel brokers. And frankly, other people in markets have had enough, and they're insisting that things start to change. And because the camel brokers are coming under pressure, it means more of them are willing to do deals verbally as opposed to under the cloak. It's also helping the others in the market that before, these camel brokers were the only ones that actually knew the prices that the herders back in the rural areas were willing to accept. But nowadays, anyone with a mobile phone and WhatsApp is able to chat to a clan member in the hinterland and say, hey, how much are you selling those camels for in the market?
That was John McDermott, chief Africa correspondent at The Economist. He was speaking to The Intelligence, a podcast from our partners at Economist Radio. Dude, where's my car? That's what a lot of people are wondering these days. If you're looking to buy a new or used car, good luck. Dealer lots are empty. Inventory is scarce. As it so happens, two of our editors are looking to buy cars and are going through the process. And because they're editors, they dug into what's going on. The World's Monica Campbell in the San Francisco Bay Area and Jason Margolis here in Boston. Monica, let me start with you. You spread the net wide and are looking for a new or used car. Doesn't really matter. Any luck?
Yeah, so I haven't bought a new car. I have this 13-year-old Volkswagen Golf, and it's time for an upgrade. You know, safety reasons, I got a kid, all this sort of stuff. All the folks on the lots are telling me about this shortage of semiconductor chips. There's a huge backlog, and cars are just not arriving, particularly from parts of Asia, Japan, Toyotas, Hondas, Subarus. So I've been kind of going back and forth to this Subaru dealership by my house here in the Bay Area. And I spoke with Joel Benjamin. He is a car salesperson, and he kind of explained what's going on. Apparently, the shortage in the semiconductor chips is starting to ease up a bit, but a bit more context from him on this.
They did not have the parts to make the cars. So the chips are starting to be more plentiful, but then you've got backlogs in production. You know, have you ever seen like those pictures of like an anaconda or a boa constrictor swallowing something that's so much larger than itself, and it just like a giant blockage that has to work its way through all the way through? And we're almost to that point.
So the chips are apparently coming in now, but you've got all these other backlogs.
In this day and age of super wired cars, you need those semiconductor chips. Otherwise, the car is just not going to run. Jason, you're trying to upgrade your current car. You also cover economics for the show. So take us deeper into the problem, starting with used cars. A year ago, the used car lots around Boston seemed full. I passed one the other day and it was practically empty. Where are all the used cars?
Well, in order to get a used car, you need a car like Monica's. You need her to turn in her old car for a different car, and then someone else can buy Monica's car. But people like Monica aren't selling her car because she can't get a new one to replace it. Make sense?
Mm.
The other reason is there's a surge in demand for used cars right now. A lot of people haven't been wanting to take the subways, for example, in major metro areas, so they need cars to get around. A lot of people fled the cities during the pandemic and moved to Wyoming or wherever to relocate their lives, and so they need cars. And then you have Hertz and Avis and other rental car agencies. They sold a lot of their inventory when nobody was traveling last year, and now they need to buy a bunch of cars quickly because people are suddenly traveling again, so we're competing against them.
The other thing that I'm being told, I want a slightly bigger car because I have this small car, and people are taking road trips, and so you want a slightly bigger car, and that is another factor.
And Jason, what about the new cars? Why aren't they there?
So as Monica said, a major problem is the semiconductor shortage. So your cars aren't just hunks of metal. They're basically computers, and you need those chips to make them work. And why is there a shortage? Well, a year ago, a lot of factories, a lot of auto manufacturers stopped building cars, and they stopped putting in the orders for chips. And now, all of a sudden, when there's this demand, they say, we need the chips. And the chip makers say, wait a second, we've already promised these semiconductors to other electronic items that need them, like phones, for example. So now they're essentially at the back of the line. Throw in acts of God. You had a fire in a big chip maker factory in Japan. You had a freeze in Texas. And there's even more of a shortage. So you literally have cars that are completely built on lots, and they're waiting for one chip to get in there so whatever, the carburetor can work properly.
So, Monica, any creative ideas on how you're going to get a car? I mean, what does it look like when you go rogue looking for wheels?
I mean, there's car sharing. Actually, one of my neighbors is interested in my car, and I'm thinking, maybe we can just figure out a way that we can share cars. But the number one advice that I'm getting is just be patient. The cars are at a premium price. Even used cars are more expensive. So just wait, and I can putter around, and it's all good. I'll survive.
The World's Monica Campbell and Jason Margolis staying optimistic. Good luck to both of you, and thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
For Father's Day on Sunday, a story now about the father-child bond. Mama Nikki is a Haitian-American artist in Seattle. Their mother is white, born in the U.S., their father, black and Haitian. On their recent album, Mama Exposed, Mama Nikki dives into that family dynamic. They spoke with Miklit Hadero, host of our series, Movement.
Can you tell us a little bit about your father?
Man, he was a cool dude. He always had, like, the right afro. He always had the right top on. He just looked cool. You know what I mean? Like, I've always been drawn to my dad. Like, when I went to the closet, I always put on his shoes. I always went through his wallet. I think in hindsight, I know that I was looking for my identity. There were times when people would look at, you know, and not think that that was my dad. You know what I mean? Because my sister's darker than I am. And I think I always wanted to be close because I always wanted some kind of acknowledgement that that was my dad.
Because I saw a forever in you. And I saw the moon shine through.
I think folks that are mixed in general are constantly having that battle. And even when I was in Haiti, I knew. I'll never be seen as Haitian, ever. Not just because I'm American, but also because of how light I was. I was like any other white American that came over. You know what I mean? I think I was probably always trying to search for some kind of connection there that I didn't realize.
And I saw the moon shine through.
So when you go into a Haitian home, every time you go into somebody's house, you eat. And every time that you have to visit everybody, and if you miss somebody, somebody's going to get their feelings hurt and they're going to talk about it. And there was one house. I just remember showing up, I think it was the second house or something like that, and going in and sitting down. There's already a plate for me, and it's just a slab of fish and I think some rice and beans, but I couldn't even see the rest of the plate right now. All I see is the fish. Because it was the whole fish, and it was the head and the eyeball that just kind of like was glossed. You know what I mean? I think I was like 13 or 14. And I was just supposed to sit there and eat it, and it just was not going to happen. My dad was trying to explain to our family, and it was this like insulting look just down at me. And I'm just like, my bad.
Go to sleep, my children sleep.
It's funny how family can have a lot of expectation that comes kind of hand in hand, mixed up with the love and care, tangled up together somehow.
There's always love in it. There's always love in it, especially in a Haitian home.
But he was really your connection to your Haitian family and community.
Yeah. I think he struggled in America in general, and I think he actually pushed away from it. The only time I ever heard him speak Creole was when he was talking to his mom. I think because he came to America and people couldn't even say his name, Jean, and changed it to Gino, I think he had his own self issues and not understanding that they should be able to say your name correctly and that you shouldn't have to change anything about yourself. And you should be able to teach your kids your life,
yeah,
you know, and your family. I don't want to say he was ashamed, because I don't think that's what it was. I think he was just, maybe he just didn't want it, us to have it as hard as him.
My God, I need thee. My God, please hear.
Tell us a little bit about the album that you made for your father.
The cover is a picture of me and my dad when I was like crawling still.
You love me.
I think because my dad and I were so close for so long, and then when the affair happened, I was so mad at him. I was so mad, and I kind of cut him off a little bit because I just felt like he was messing up. I mean, his phone calls were, because he was still getting paid by my mom from the divorce, he'd ask where his check was. Even when he got sick, that was a lot of what was going on. He's like, are you going to be able to bring that by? And he'd still be going to the casino. And so there was just so much anger. It took me a long time to forgive him. But my mom was, I can't remember if it was my mom or somebody else, but more or less that I would regret if I didn't. I think I had gone in the studio right before he decided to stop doing dialysis. And so I asked my producer to send me whatever version that he had so my dad could listen to it. Because they told us when you're hopping off of dialysis, you've got somewhere between 3 to 5 days. And he is as stubborn as anyone else and decided he was going to last like 30 plus days. He passed 2 days after his birthday.
But he was proud.
Yeah, he's proud. He's proud. Yeah.
Maybe I can see the sunrise. Maybe I can watch the moon shine. Maybe I can touch the rain.
When I wrote this one song on the album, I think I titled it as My House.
My God loves me.
I sing that song in the space over and over again, like it was healing the walls, while it was healing like the walls of like my insides.
And this is my house.
And every time that I do a performance, I generally open with that song, because it's been my healing when I think about my dad. I'll listen to the song or I'll start singing it. So it's constantly healing. And I also send that album out to other people that are going through trauma. Like, here, take this. You know what I mean? Like, this is part of your healing kit. So that you have the space to grieve and also have the space to, like, to breathe. Because it is for me. And I hope it is for others.
Mama Nikki's father, Jean Bonnier-Etienne, died in 2018. Our series Movement is produced by McLeod Hedero and Ian Koss. Find all the artists we featured at theworld.org/movement. The story was developed as part of the University of Washington's Arts and Creativity Initiative, funded by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation and supported by the Meany Center for the Performing Arts. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Happy Juneteenth and a happy Father's Day to you. We'll see you back here Monday.